This is a download from the BBC. For more information and our terms of use, go to bbc.co.uk/radio3.
Go into any bookshop today or look at an online bookseller and you'll find whole sections devoted to food, diet and cooking. Switch on the television or the radio and you'll find programmes devoted to the same topic. It may seem a peculiarly 21st century preoccupation, but people in Shakespeare's England were also obsessed with food. Dietary books advising people on what to eat and why in order to maintain good health were enormously popular in the period. When we consider Shakespeare's plays, in the light of the information available in these dietary books, surprising connections between the two begin to emerge. Eating is about more than just food, because it tells us about the social hierarchies, religious controversies, national and gender stereotypes, even the fashions that so dominated the lives of people in Renaissance England, including Shakespeare himself. Dietary books gave the Renaissance reader guidance on adjusting the balance of the humours, blood, phlegm, colour and melancholy. According to humoral theory, maintaining an ideal complexion or balance of humours was something you could get through proper diet and a good night's sleep, as well as breathing good air and getting enough exercise. But aspects of identity also affected your complexion, for example, nationality, gender, social class and age. Andrew Board's Compendious Regiment, first printed in 1542, and William Bullen's Government of Health, first printed in 1558, are two important Renaissance dietaries. Board's Compendious Regiment warns against eating and drinking to excess, and often remarks upon the behaviour and diet of English people, noting that the English spend too long sitting at dinner and supper, feeding on heavy meats before lighter ones, which isn't good for their digestion. William Bullen's Government of Health takes the form of a dialogue between John, a self-confessed glutton, and Humphrey, a man of moderate habits. The idea that gluttony was bad for physical health was reinforced in the pulpit, where churchgoers would hear a homily against gluttony and drunkenness. In Sir John Falstaff, Shakespeare's notorious glutton, we're presented with a pretty ambivalent character, one who defies both dietary and religious authorities by eating and drinking to excess whenever he pleases. It was generally believed that eating meat was divinely ordained, and the dietary authors promoted meat as more healthy than a vegetarian diet, although there were lots of factors to be taken into consideration, including whether or not a specific meat was suited to one's humour, occupation, and even nationality. For example, bacon was thought fitting only for labourers or those involved in physical activity because it was considered difficult to digest and vigorous work would help the digestion process. Chicken was regarded more favourably and was specifically recommended by some as a food for the sick. But chicken was expensive in Shakespeare's time, so only the wealthy would eat the bird's flesh, although many would keep chickens for their eggs. In Shakespeare, capons are an indulgence. They are a favourite of Sir John Falstaff, and in The Two Gentlemen of Verona, Launce's dog, Crab, steals a capon leg from Sylvia's table. Both Falstaff and Crab, the dog, are rule breakers, characters who do as they please and when they like. The dietary author Andrew Board thought that beef was good meat for an Englishman, a view that disagrees with ancient medical authorities such as Galen, who believed that beef was a cold and heavy meat that provoked melancholy. It was thought that the cold English climate made English stomachs hotter than those of their Mediterranean neighbours, and so better able to digest a meat like beef, which was also more tender in England due to the manner in which it was produced. for example, the feeding upon green pasture. William Bullen confirms this when he states, "Much beef, customably eaten of idle persons and nice folks that labour not, bringeth many diseases. But unto hot, strong, choleric stomachs it is tolerable, and may be used, as we have the daily experience thereof." These days, we are generally encouraged by health professionals to eat more fish and reduce our intake of red meat. But in Shakespeare's time, fish was considered inferior to meat because it was thought to be less nourishing. But it was also associated with the Catholic practice of not eating meat on Fridays. Fish days had been introduced by the government for economic reasons, to encourage the fishing industry and bring down the high price of meat. But fish days were disliked by England's Protestants because they reminded them of England's Catholic past. In King Lear, the disguised Kent says to Lear, "I do profess to be no less than I seem, to serve him truly that will put me in trust, to love him that is honest, to converse with him that is wise and says little, to fear judgment, to fight when I cannot choose, and to eat no fish." This all suggests that Kent is a loyal Protestant, and therefore a man who can be trusted. Animal flesh was preferred over fish, and also considered healthier than fruit, a term that included not only what we consider fruit today, but also what we consider vegetables. Fruit was believed to be full of water that could cause a harmful imbalance in the body. It was generally believed that before the biblical flood, the human constitution was stronger and fruits contained less moisture, but that after the flood, fruit provided less nourishment and made men more vulnerable to disease. It was believed to be at this point that God ordained the consumption of animal flesh by humans. Dietary authors advised eating fruit only occasionally and before meals, avoiding the French habit of eating it after meals for dessert. Of course, despite warnings from the dietaries and elsewhere, people still ate fruit, which was sold in the streets and markets and picked from bushes and in hedgerows by those who could not afford to buy it or be fussy about what they ate. New and fashionable fruits, such as apricots and melons, were being imported into England from southern Europe. And dried fruits, such as raisins and figs, were also available to those who could afford them. Pumpkin seeds have been found in excavations of the Rose and Globe playhouses. And so it's possible that pumpkins or pumpkin seeds were consumed by wealthier members of the audience. Pumpkins were considered especially watery. In The Merry Wives of Windsor, Mistress Ford describes Falstaff as "this unwholesome humidity, this gross watery pumpkin." For modern readers, one of the strangest ideas to emerge from early modern dietary books is the fact that human breast milk was recommended as a drink for adults as well as children. For example, William Bullen claims, "the best milk that helpeth against consumptions is woman's milk." When we recognise this, references to milk and milkiness in the plays begin to make more sense. Lady Macbeth worries that her husband is too full of the milk of human kindness. And Shakespeare's audiences and readers would inevitably wonder how he came to be so. The line is clearly figurative, but might there be a literal suggestion too? Has Macbeth been drinking human milk? Human milk was given to the old, the sick, and to babies. And everything we have seen of Macbeth so far suggests the opposite. A vigorous man in his prime. This discrepancy perhaps tells us more about Lady Macbeth than about her husband, that she has unnaturally high expectations of masculinity. In a similar way, Goneril in King Lear criticises her husband Albany for his milky gentleness, although all the audience sees is his sympathy for the mistreated old king. These accusations of milkiness suggest two kinds of weakness, the producers of milk were weak because they were women, and the consumers were the weak, the old, the sick, or babies. Changes in fashion and immigration meant that beer was becoming more popular than traditional English ale. Andrew Board thought that ale for an Englishman is a natural drink and disapproved of beer, now of late days much used in England to the detriment of many Englishmen. Beer was foreign because it used hops that were often imported and required the brewing expertise of Flemish immigrants. In Henry V, Falstaff's boy longs for the English refreshment during battle with the French. Would I were in an alehouse in London. I would give all my fame for a pot of ale and safety. Longing for beer would not have had the same nationalist and nostalgic appeal. Women brewers, known as brewsters, dominated ale production in medieval England, just as women dominated the manufacture of dairy produce. But they were gradually sidelined as brewing, and particularly the brewing of beer, was taken over by men. Alewives had a bad reputation, not least for watering down the customers' drinks. In The Taming of the Shrew, Christopher Sly, insisting that he is not a lord, but a tinker, says, "Ask Marion Hackett, the fat alewife of Wincot, if she knows me not." Wine, which was expensive and so outside the reach of most ordinary people, was generally considered better than beer and ale by the dietary authors. The sack often consumed by Sir John Falstaff was a fortified wine, imported from Spain and the Canary Islands. Sack was dry, but the English usually sweetened it by adding sugar to it before it was served. In Shakespeare's time, people thought that sugar was healthy. Indeed, it was used as a medicine to treat lots of conditions, such as stomach problems. Andrew Board approves of all food and drink containing sugar as especially nutritious. And it was thought that old people craved sugar. Falstaff's desire for sugar explains why he is called Sack and Sugar Jack by Poins in Henry IV, Part 2. Andrew Board also warns against giving wine to young unmarried women because it was thought to be warming and heat-provoked lust. In Henry IV, Part 2, Mistress Quickly tells Doll Tearsheet that she has drunk too much Spanish wine. Diet and identity were complex issues in Shakespeare's England, and dietary books from the period allow us an insight into what people thought about food and well-being. They can also help us better understand Shakespeare's plays. They reveal beliefs, just like contemporary diet books, that certain foods are better for us than others. We may not always agree what those foods are, but what we do share with consumers of the past is a belief that good health, above all other things, is what matters most.